another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard up in Shasta Lake City. And you can reach them for anything involving ag tractors, turf equipment, service, sales. They do it all up there. Give them a call at 226-9226 or get them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Well,
there we go.
Well, let's see. What else do we need to tell people? Robert just fell down or broke his camera. What's going on in the background? That's our own private entertainment. Let's see. We need to let you know that everything about the program can be found at wethepeopleradio.us, and we've got about 10 years of archives for you. They are free to listen to, and we have taken the free market out of it. So although we love our advertisers, we took it out for your faster listening. How's that? So you can crunch the show in like hour and 35 minutes instead of two. So there you go. Please send it to a friend. It's all there to be posted to Facebook and all that other jazz. And we hope you find it. Well, it should be entertaining, but it should be mostly educational. But yeah, as we all know, no one learns anything if it isn't fun. Or maybe that's it's just me. I don't learn anything if it isn't fun. So our guest today is Dr. Josh Umber. And all I know about him is he's a board-certified family physician and the founder of Atlas MD, a direct primary care medical practice. That's the extent of the biography I have on him. I'm sure there's more. I do have a picture of him, though, so I could pick him out of a lineup, just in case it ever comes to that. Although I don't know what state he lives in. And I have a great article from him on here. It's called, it's a new study, Home Visit Doctors Reduce Emergency Room Visits. What a great idea. And oh, by how much? Yeah, over 40%, which could obviously dramatically lower your healthcare bills.
That's huge.
So that article is from August 18th, 2020. It's posted on there, and it was from, help me out, Dr. Umber.
From the Millen Group, yes, a actuary firm that researches all kinds of things.
Nice. So anything else you'd like to add to your biography besides your picture and that very brief thing that you're an actual doctor?
Yeah. We've been in this new model of care for actually 10 years.
Oh, wow.
But now with COVID, it's generating a lot more attention as people are looking for new ways to either solve healthcare problems, find cheaper care, and just kind of innovate.
Nice.
Yeah.
So we'll take it away. We'll just let you kind of drive the bus and we'll learn, because obviously we're not doctors.
I played one on TV once.
Bill hasn't even played one on the radio. Don't believe anything he says.
I'm like a doctor in Mexico.
Oh, there you go.
First time for everything. Yeah.
Exactly. Bill's terrified of shots, though, so all you have to do is say injection and Bill goes down.
So we're in a model called direct primary care. And the idea is kind of Netflix to Blockbuster. You don't have car insurance for gasoline, life insurance for lawn care, or home insurance for lawn care, life insurance for groceries. So why have health insurance for the routine things, the things that we can make affordable? And I think that the reason we buy health insurance differently is because people don't think it could be made to be very affordable. And so when we can show them this new model, which is, again, like Netflix. It's a flat membership-based model. So adults pay $10 per month per kid. I'm sorry, children. And adults will pay $50 to $100 per month based on their age. But all pre-existing conditions are welcome. And in exchange for that, they get unlimited home visits, work visits, office visits, free telemedicine, so they can call, text, or email their doctor 24/7. And we try to find more ways to innovate and add value. So a couple of those things are we've eliminated copays. So now there's no longer copay whenever you talk to your doctor. We want to encourage people to get more care more often, because an ounce of prevention is really worth a pound of care.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But we can also do fun things like all procedures in the office are included free of charge. EKGs, stitches, biopsies, joint injections. An EKG only cost me 36 cents. The coffee in the waiting room costs 70 cents a cup. And I can't bill your insurance for the coffee, so why jump through all the hoops to bill your insurance for the 36 cents EKG?
Right.
But doctors do that because they're so overwhelmed and burdened and high overhead that they need to make money everywhere they can, and insurance doesn't pay over here, so they upcharge them over there. And it's this real, you know, kind of whack-a-mole system we have. But we can take that even further, and we do things like wholesale medicines and labs. So Walmart has a $4 a month list. We have a $4 a year list when we can make medicines a penny a pill or less by going direct to the manufacturer.
Wow.
Routine blood work, $1 or $2 a test. So now when you think that primary care incomes is about, you know, 80-20, 80% of what you need, your family doc, your pediatrician, your intern can manage for you, but now they can do it on an affordable level, which means you can buy less expensive insurance but not feel like you have less coverage for the big thing.
Hmm. Wow.
Well, I guess the thing that comes to my mind first is, how can you make any money with a $10 a month membership fee and have unlimited home visits?
Do you have a real office?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Oh, okay.
We have a yep. And so, great questions. It's actually easier to make money in this model than the standard model because 70% of traditional model is just overhead. The average doctor has 5 to 7 full-time staff to help them play the insurance game.
Right.
So they have to charge more, see people, you know, more people per day for less time each, and over-focus on documenting the way the insurance wants them to so that they can get paid.
Hmm.
So it creates this rat race where you're moving faster but getting less results. Just like Airbnb can simplify, you know, getting a hotel room to the point that they're worth more than the Hilton Empire, but they don't own any hotel rooms. Silicon Valley tends to innovate by making things faster, easier, simpler, and more affordable. So that's what we're trying to do for healthcare.
That's kind of great. And so does it take, do you have to have a whole network of clinics doing this in order to make that work, or can it be a standalone? I mean, like, how many doctors does it take to screwing a light bulb? No, that's not it. How many doctors does it take to...
One doctor and a really good nurse.
Like, you know, because I'm thinking, okay, if you're making home visits, you're not at the office and, you know, that sort of thing. So just like I guess it all depends on, are you in a rural area, are you in a city? That's probably a factor. Where are you anyway?
Like, so we're in Wichita, Kansas.
Oh, so you're probably in a kind of... you've got a rural component.
Sort of. I think we're the 49th largest city.
But you probably take people
from the bottom. But yeah.
Well, that's kind of neat. So okay, so are you in the city?
We are.
Oh, okay.
We've helped over 900 doctors and 600 practices launch like this in the country.
Oh.
They're all independently owned and operated. So we have groups in Buena Vista, Colorado, a town of 2,500, up to, you know, your L.A.'s, New York, Chicago, Miami-type places. Each area has, you know, its own pros and cons in terms of structure of the business, but it still works. I think healthcare ends up being a commodity like milk or gasoline. Everybody needs it, and they're very sensitive about the price.
Sure.
So,
and if people can get that basic care, especially for their kids, because... You know, I mean, we all know little kids are germ factories, and you know, they have a multitude of things. And if you can take them in without making it a big deal, and especially if you have, you know, more than one kid, if you guys are doing house calls, well, that's fantastic.
Well, you know, I think people are worried that they're always one fall down, go boom, away from, you know, medical debt, and the kids running around playing, trips on their Halloween costume, splits their eyebrow
sure.
open. Then they go to the ER and get a $2,000 bill for stitches we do for free. Because they cost us, probably by the time you include everything, $2 or $3. Stitches, lidocaine, cleaning supplies, etc.
Wow.
So, but again, to compare that to Netflix, how can I have 10,000 plus videos in my pocket for $10 a month?
But they did, well, I was going to say, but they didn't have to go to medical school, but they do have to do all the licensing, and there's more
right?
to it than just having it in the... All right, hold that thought, and we'll come right back. Huh, this is fun. It was something we never thought about. So our guest is Dr. Josh Umber. We're chatting about, he has created Atlas MD, a direct primary care medical practice. Sort of interesting. You can find out more about the article and all that. It is at wethepeopleradio.us. What shall we do about them? When they move into your neighborhood, they take over, but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them? We the People Radio is now on television in the Reading area. KRDT Channel 23.10, Tuesday and Wednesday nights at 10 p.m. on the American Uncensored Network. Brother bought a coconut, he bought it for the diamond. Sister hiding out of one, she paid it for the lime. She put the lime in the coconut, she drank and pulled up. She put the lime in the coconut, she called a doctor, woke him up and said, Doctor, ain't there nothing I can take? I said, Doctor, do you relieve this bellyache? I said, Doctor, ain't there nothing I can take? I said, Doctor. There you go. We just practice medicine without a license. Oh, totally forgot about that song until about 3 o'clock this morning. Oh my goodness. Okay, so we have questions, real ones.
Fire away.
You know, the more you think about it, the more questions you have. So we're thinking. So what if you travel? Like, what if you're out of town? What do? Your doctor's in Wichita.
For most travel-related things, they end up being coughs, colds, migraines, nausea, vomiting, stuff that we can end up managing by calls, texts, emails, video chat. We can still prescribe medications to a pharmacy while our patients are traveling.
That's true.
So now you still have that continuity of care.
Sure.
Without having to pay a big urgent care or emergency room type fee.
And in real life, example, the way medicine is set up now, your doctor isn't available by phone, so actually you have more access through yours than you do through the regular way. If you think about it.
Exactly. Okay. One quick example is a family about ready to board a cruise ship in Florida Saturday morning and realized the kid had a swimmer's ear infection from being at the hotel for a few days. So now they've got to get medicine in 30 minutes. Like, all right, give us a call, check it out. What Walgreens do you want to use? I don't even know. We're not from around here. Great. Where are you? I'll Google it. I'll call them. They'll have it ready. And we'll use eye drops instead of ear drops because the ear drops have no generic and are $180, but the eye drops are the same medicine for $6.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
There you go.
So having
that's a
that
hot tip.
Ability to have a doctor who, you know, looking out for your interests in lots of ways and is available is a real luxury.
Mm-hmm. So let's say you call your doctor, he comes out, checks you out, and it turns out to be something a little more serious where you do require maybe a specialist or a hospital. What do they do then?
Yeah, so when it comes to specialists, there's solid evidence that 40 to 50% of all referrals are unnecessary because the referring physician is just so busy. Well, I don't have more than 10 minutes with you today, so if I can't answer it now, I'm going to refer on up the ladder.
Right.
And in some hospital systems, that's how they make more money because the specialist will be paid 4 or 5 times the amount to diagnose and treat a problem compared to the family physician. So sometimes it's necessary, and sometimes it's just the system is broken. But for us, we can take more care of our patients. We have online specialists we can call, some for free, some for a payment. But worst case scenario, we still refer you on to the local specialist if the health condition warrants it.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of neat. And so what do you do if... I don't know. The clinics, like let's say somebody in some totally different state, do you have to issue state to state, or can any doctor kind of set this up?
Really, any doctor can set this up. Some states like New York make just the practice of medicine harder in general, but an insurance-free practice is legal in every state. what we find is a lot of doctors will call on each other when their patients are traveling and say, hey, I have a infant that really needs to be checked out quick. Would you mind, and can we help out? Because the more value we can bring to this group of doctors and patients, the happier everyone is. So that this grassroots movement really grows by that word of mouth. Happy patients find out how well this works for them. They talk to their doctor. They encourage them to expand into this model. Some just want it. Some need it. We talk about the pricing on medications. There's a migraine medicine that's $200 or $300 a month at the pharmacy cash price that we get for $5 a month. So some people just go to their doctor and say, please do this model because I need that medicine and I need to save $200 or $300 a month.
So I guess I don't understand why.
I want to ask that too.
Why is it so much cheaper for you folks than it is for my GP to float it into the local pharmacy? I mean, as far as the prescription costs go.
Yeah, great question, because I think we've been giving people bad information to make bad decisions for a long time. We tell them that there's a $10 copay for generic and a $20 copay for name brand, so we assume there's a reasonable difference between medicines. And in reality, the copay is just a portion the patient's paying. The insurance is getting billed hundreds of dollars more. And so now it's just making the patient make a small decision, but the pharmacy wants to see how much can we bill your insurance company for. And then we're a little shocked when premiums go up every year. Hmm. So, CVS, Walgreens, you name them. For every other product on the shelf, their goal is to get you the best price. But when it comes to the pharmaceutical side, that's their high markup area. They want to see the most money and most return they can do versus most other industries. That last time I went to Best Buy, they found me a coupon online to match a competitor's price because they didn't want to lose my business. So I'd like to say that the medicines are cheaper because we're so great or something proprietary that only we can do, but it's not. The reality is that is the wholesale cost. When you go to the wholesale suppliers or direct to the manufacturer, the medicines cost pennies for a lot of things there. They're getting marked up to dollars per pill at the pharmacy side.
So I'm kind of naive when it comes to how the whole medicine part works. Do the pharmacies all pay the same for the drug, and then they set the price that they sell it for? And I'm sure there's a different price for cash versus if they have an insurance company, because on the insurance company side, I think they already just kind of preset what they'll pay for a drug. Is that right?
Oh, it's way more complicated than that.
Yeah,
it's an octopus of all these different middlemen and PBMs, pharmacy benefit managers, who get pharmaceutical company and the retail pharmacy. Here's what you can charge. Here's what you can't charge, on different medicines. And it's really convoluted the whole process so much that the prices only keep going up.
Right.
Oh, and that kind of makes sense, too. And the other thing is that the doctor seems to always have to fight with, always has to fight with the stupid insurance company on whether or not you can even get the thing. Do you still have to wrangle with all that kind of jazz?
No, that's the beautiful part. The work that you shouldn't be doing is the work that doesn't add any value. And for each doctor to try to memorize 10 different insurance companies with 10 different types of plans and different coverage is impossible. So, but rather than play that game, we just provide the medication. Clinics like this provide the medication directly so that I know that name brand Lexapro is $12 a pill wholesale, but generic Lexapro is 4 cents a pill. So now when it's $1.20 a month, we don't need to involve an insurance company in the process. The patient can just decide, do they want Zoloft for 80 cents a month, Lexapro for $1.20 a month? They get to make these decisions. And while at the same time saving 30 to 60% on the insurance premiums.
That's kind of a good idea. And so, okay, let's say you have somebody who has a whole bunch of, you know, ongoing, you know, they have cardiac stuff. And so you just, you're like regular primary care, and they still have a cardiologist and that kind of thing?
Well, they might. You know, a lot of family terms will manage cardiac problems.
Oops, so hold on. Your phone broke up bad. Say that one more time.
So a lot of primary care physicians will still manage cardiology-type issues, so we can rely on a specialist to help with the initial diagnosis or, you know, adjustments to the medicine, but then the follow-up care come back. But then we know that, you know, metoprolol can be 2 cents a pill, but other medicines might be 10 cents a pill. But we can talk with the patient, decide which one is right for them.
Interesting. And so when they go, how do you actually control the cost at the pharmacy?
Well, no, we keep them in-house because now the pharmacy, they're, you know, right or wrong, their job is to see higher stock returns. CVS, Walgreens.
Okay, so they're not going to the pharmacy. That's how. So you guys are literally dispensing
in-house.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. That yeah. Actually makes more sense. So I was like, hey, wait a second. How'd you get the pharmacy to play along with this gig? Can you imagine? You got a bunch of people in line. It's like, oh, you owe us 4 cents, and the guy behind him's like, what?
Yeah. The value here is to show how we can save them more than the cost of the membership. There's a medicine that's $66 a pill at the pharmacy that Medicare won't pay for Medicare patients. And we get for 13 cents a pill. So it's all about thinking about this like a business. How do we provide enough value to the patient
sure. To
show them how they, you know, save money and are getting high quality, cost effective care?
Sure.
Sure, because that's your inventory. You guys are, you know, kind of like mechanics. I mean, if all your parts are marked up too high, you can't run your shop. Okay, hold on 5 seconds, and we will be right back because this is a super fun idea. So when we come back, I'd like to know how you're marketing this out. How are people finding out about it? And well, hopefully we're helping with that a little bit. But how do doctors find out about this? And I want to make sure we have good contact information so we don't run out of time for you. So you're listening to We the People, and you can join us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of years without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can. Doctor, my eyes, tell me what is wrong. Was I unwise? So long. Do you like country with a funky thing? Here's a man to me. Hey, do you like the sound of champion feet? Here can be me.
If medicine doesn't work out, you can be a rock and roll doctor. It's a good song for that. In the Wayback Machine. So, okay, you guys have this model going. You have how many doctors are participating?
We have over 1,200 doctors doing this model across the country.
Wow! And so, I suppose it varies by the place and how they're set up and stuff. But like in a practice. If you were going to do this, would this be a great thing for like just a one doctor, one nurse operation, or do you kind of need to have a few more people to cover everything?
A lot of the doctors will start off like that, very lean and small, because it's a new model and they're trying to be smart with their operating budget. But yeah, that's really all you need is a doctor, a patient, and often a good nurse. So they'll start off at small clinics and then over the years start to expand into multiple doctors at multiple locations. Hmm.
And then you mentioned lab work. What do you do your own lab work?
No, we use the same large national companies, but we bill it different. And if you go through insurance, it's a big hassle with high expense because of all the paperwork. But also insurance gets to say, no, we don't want to pay for that. We don't think it was necessary.
Right.
So when we just bill direct, we say, we'll pay for everything. So what's the best cash price? Fast, easy, simple for them. We can get a thyroid test for $1.70, a CBC for $1.50. We can check your cholesterol panel for $3. We can see if you have diabetes for $2.
Hmm. And so all of that, you just billed, that's additional charge on top of your $10 a month?
Correct. We just do our cost plus 10%, so that it's very transparent. Everybody knows what the price is going to be up front, and that way there's no surprise billing or shock when they get the bill.
Hmm.
Well, that's crazy.
Well, it sounds like
right.
Yeah,
we're having a hard time wrapping our mind around this.
Insanity. It would probably make sense then to have insurance only for like major medical, which is a lot cheaper than full spectrum health insurance.
Right.
And then use your plan for the day to dailies.
We kind of joke. We'll sell you the craftiest insurance plan you've ever loved. because now we simplify. We carve out all the things you don't need. If you look at, and most people probably can't see this, but an employer could, what the insurance is actually paying out for a group of people, 30% of that can just be the co-payments. And then when you combine meds and labs, that can be another 30 or 40%. So actual expensive ER room, hospital care, surgical care type things makes up a smaller portion of your total insurance costs than people realize.
Right.
So when you can find a way to eliminate copays, procedure fees, decrease ER visits, when you have a doctor available 24/7, then a lot of these things get taken care of faster, easier, cheaper, which means now you can feel comfortable having quote-unquote cheap insurance.
Sure.
Now you don't try to get car insurance that pays for gasoline. You don't want more insurance.
Yeah, right.
15 minutes will save you 15%. People are actively looking for the cheapest insurance they can for their car.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, even for life insurance. They're not trying to pay more.
How does this compare or differ with what they're calling like concierge these concierge things that are like a membership sort of like this? But I don't think they do all the pharmacy. I've never heard that before.
No, they typically don't.
Okay.
Concierge medicine started in the late 90s, kind of $25,000 per person per year, real high-end. But airbags started only on high-end cars. So direct care is the affordable concierge, blue-collar concierge. Still membership-based, but bringing the price down to a reasonable level, but trying to add so much value back to it that this would be something that makes more sense for a person. That way, what we hear is, how do I afford my insurance plus a membership?
Right.
To which we would say, how do you afford your insurance without the membership?
Well, right. Because, I mean,
it allows you to carve that down.
Yeah, because, I mean, you get people that, like Erin, she's old. Her insurance costs her a lot of money. I mean, $600-$900 a month.
I've been asked since I was a little kid. They're like, oh, we're going to charge her.
Yeah. So you could eliminate that. And I mean, just that alone, that monthly fee alone, if you cut that in half, you're saving $500 a month.
100.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you're right. The medication, like a lot of people they can't even get their insurance to cover the medication. I hear that a lot. Talk to me about, because I'm thinking about somebody in particular who had to have a really specialized cancer-type medication. Do you guys get into that whole thing?
We can even help there. Now, we'll be the first to say we can't fix everything.
That's kind of the Nirvana fallacy,
But there is a lot. We try to fix everything we can. So we had a patient one of the medications for her breast cancer treatment, she was quoted as $600 per month at the pharmacy mm-hmm. with her high-quality insurance that we could get generic wholesale for $6.
Wow.
A 99% difference. We gave her the first month free just so we could say we did. She was in shock. We were in shock. We don't do a lot of chemo meds as family doctors, you know, but we found, we recommended the mammogram, we found the mass, we referred on to the oncologist, he recommended the medicine, but it came back to us to get the medicine affordable because we have the time, and in this case, the experience, the know-how, to search for that medicine. One search, 2 minutes, came back, here's the price, name brand versus generic.
Dang.
We even called the oncologist and say, is the generic okay? I had no idea the price was that different, but yeah, the generic is fine. So that's sort of worst case to best case scenario, you know, high priced name brand to low price generic. But we had a brain cancer patient. Insurance was going to be billed $26,000 for a medicine we could get for $1,900. So there's a lot of opportunity for us to reach outside, you know, our normal boundaries to still help lower the cost of care.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's a biggie. A lot of times, whatever the person has, they can afford the actual care. But when it comes to the medication, either I hear a lot that the medication is too expensive. That's pretty common. But anymore, the pharmaceutical companies and the insurance companies together, I don't know who's really the boss of it, but they're playing doctor, and they won't give the person the medication that the doctor wants to prescribe, and this allows you guys to actually do your job.
You know, it's a little bit of competition.
Clever idea.
It's realizing that the pharmacy no longer is the last stop to get medicine, and it's basically what you call an economic cartel. 3 or 4 of the large pharmaceutical companies control over 70% of the market. So they're not as interested in lowering the price. For someone like a Bezos, who lost $5 on every Kindle ebook he sold for the first year just to break the stranglehold publishing houses had on electronic books, or Walmart, that traditionally only expects a 2 to 3% profit margin on everything in their store, but they broke with their own ethics and operating procedure when it came to the medication, and will let 1,000% markup through. So now it's getting to realize that there is a lot of room to make these things much cheaper than they are. You know, blood pressure medicine, a penny a pill, cholesterol medicine, a penny a pill, antidepressants, 2 or 3 cents a pill. You know, if people realize that this is how affordable care could be, then you start to realize, how much could I save in health insurance?
Mm-hmm.
And to your point, $500 per month, that's real money. You know,
oh yeah!
That's $6,000
a year towards credit card debt, towards mortgages, towards college education. That's huge.
Yeah, you're right, and that's money out of your pocket every month. $500. If you could drop that down to a fraction of that, like you say, that money could go towards paying off everything else you got in your life, and if some major medical thing did come along, you look at how much you saved up to that point.
Right.
It really isn't going to cost you that much.
Let's say we have somebody listening who's a family care physician who's looking at the rules and the regs and all the idiotic stuff they can't do and thinking, hey, wait a minute, this sounds like a way to go. How do they find out about this? How would they contact you?
Yeah, they can reach out to us directly. Hello@atlas.md is our email. Our website is atlas.md. We have a chat button there as well. Patients can reach out to us. We will help them find a doctor like us in their area. But we also have all the materials for starting a practice like this for free on our website because we're passionate about the mission, help doctors and patients realize that DPC is a better model for everyone.
That's a great idea, and you guys aren't even hippies or anything. You spelled Atlas like it's supposed to be spelled. God bless you.
Exactly.
I hate those people who take a simple word and they like put a Y in it or something. You're like, really? Now no one's going to find you. So Atlas, just like the shrugging, and you don't have to mm-hmm. shrug anymore. Now you got the MD thing. That is a great idea. And you've been doing this how long again?
So September 2nd was our 10-year anniversary.
Dang. Dang. So you've been around as long as we have.
Say,
how come we've never met? That's pretty amazing. And so I'm kind of curious. I know we're going to come up against a break, but maybe when we come back, I'm curious if the pharmaceutical industry or any of the, you know, I mean, there's a whole machinery that would be fairly invested in not having you do well. I'm curious what has transpired over the past 10 years and have you had roadblocks and visits from attorneys and, I don't know, regulators and whatnot. We'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Josh Umber. We are discussing, let's see, the website again was atlas.md, and I think you ought to go look at it. And if you can't remember that and you're only, you know, you listen to us all the time and you'd like to send this to a friend, it's wethepeopleradio.us.
And your thoughts won't fit together, so you sleep light or whatever, and the night goes on forever. Then you might change like the weather. You're in need of Dr. Darwin.
Couldn't resist. So when you guys started this, was there just this, I mean, did they just kind of thumb their nose at you and say, hey, it'll never work, or did they come after you?
So, yeah, a lot of people thought this would never work, doctors included.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
You know, part they were just worried that this was concierge medicine and just another young, overly doc trying to take the cream off of the crop from the town. You know, so you're going to take the rich people and make the system worse for the wear. They didn't see the potential that this would be a model that actually improved the quality and accessibility of care. But the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical actually never really fought to us.
Hmm.
The big ones, we were too small for them to pay attention to. And the little ones, little insurance companies, as an opportunity to get more market share. They said, we are already smaller and scrappy. How do we adopt new ideas so that we can lower insurance premiums to get more small businesses? You know, the giant companies don't care as much about the mom-and-pop type shops.
Sure.
And thus don't really try to compete for their business or offer high-value services.
So can you help connect people with, you know, the catastrophic plans and things like that that mm-hmm. that they may need?
We've worked with an insurance company out of Kansas City, Allied National, now for 9 years. They're in 37 states. It used to be that self-insured, partially self-insured plans, you had to be 50 employees or greater because it just wasn't worth the hassle. Now they'll go down to 2 employees that aren't husband-wife. So even very small businesses now can have the flexibility that larger companies have so that, in general, we pay about $150 per person on our insurance plan. We cover about 19 lives, pay about $2,500. So we see families paying $2,500 a month for
That'd be ours, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so more than your mortgage, more than my mortgage, in that sense. And so the small companies have told us that their profit margins are 4 times higher working with direct care practices compared to traditional insurance-based practices. We're not submitting all the paperwork. We're keeping people out of the ER. We're out-competing the lab and the retail pharmacies. So they see us as an ally in their attempt to streamline the system and bring the cost down because they can't offer lower premiums until healthcare is actually cheaper. So I don't blame insurance companies. I actually blame doctors. We're the gatekeepers of care. We're the ones prescribing name-brand medicines instead of generic medicines. We're the ones ordering expensive tests without finding solutions to make those cheaper. So although insurance may not be perfect, it can't get better until we get better. So it really depends on the doctors moving forward and adopting this innovation. But Big Pharmaceutical has seen this as a benefit as well. They're already selling the medicines to us and to pharmacies at a penny a pill. It's the retail pharmacy, the big box stores, that are marking it up, you know, thousands percent.
Yeah, I would think the CVS's of the world probably aren't real happy with it.
They are the ox that gets gored the most in this model. If they weren't ready for us to come after them, they will never be ready for Amazon. I mean, the standard business theory now is if Amazon's not coming for you, they will be. And I think that Amazon is getting into health in a big way lately. So they should be worried about Jeff Bezos offering wholesale medicines for a penny a pill to Amazon Prime members and just sweeping that business away from them.
Sure.
So that change was coming whether they noticed us or not.
Right.
I think they've been, fat on that hog plenty long enough. The same Blockbuster that made $8 in profit per movie, and laughed Netflix out of their office years ago, is now bankrupt, and Netflix is king. So innovation comes knocking regardless.
Yeah.
Wow. That's kind of amazing. How long did it take until somebody else said, hey, I want to try it? Did they wait until you had this running for a little bit?
We started with one doctor, added another in 9 months, another in about 12 months. So we were probably 2 or 3 years in before doctors from across the country started visiting the office, seeing headlines, and starting to do it themselves, which is interesting. It took Starbucks 16 years to get 17 stores, and we've gone from basically under five in 2010 to over 1,200 in just 10 years.
Jeez.
Yeah. I would think that once the word gets out on something like this, people would be compelled to look at their current plan and go, wow, it looks like, for insurance is one of those things in most cases you never use it, but you always pay for it month to month. And a deal like this, just the upfront savings alone, I would think people would be quite interested in sitting down and talking to somebody.
Do they ever experiment? Do they have just their kids do it, but they leave the grown-ups on regular insurance or things like that?
Oh, yeah. We see all kinds of mix and matches. Mom joins, but dad won't. Dad joins, but the kids won't. test the waters. We joke if it sounds too good to be true, then you should wave the BS flag.
Right.
Reality is all kinds of businesses around us are too good to be true. I'm talking on a supercomputer now that fits in my pocket, and I can't wait to get the latest supercomputer. and they get better, faster, thinner, brighter, stronger every year. So business is really good at giving us things we wouldn't expect year after year. Now it's just finally catching up to healthcare.
Yeah. Well, I think your Netflix analogy is spot on.
Perfect.
I mean, I can remember when we used to go down to the video store and spend $5 a movie and get a whole pile of them and, binge watch them
on
all
VHS.
Weekend and then take them back.
On VHS.
Yeah, on VHS, exactly.
You had to rewind those. Yeah.
That's right.
Or you got punished.
Yeah, and now with
and then
Netflix,
if you were my sister and you left them sitting on the top of your car and you backed out of your garage and drove around town and forgot they were there and then couldn't find them again.
Yeah, they were instantly $100 a movie.
It was $100. Oh, my gosh. Well, this is really hey, one question I have too is, okay, so the electronic medical records, that was a big issue for a lot of doctors. They didn't want to put all their stuff on the government site. So guys that don't take insurance but will bill for you, but like my doctor doesn't do the electronic prescriptions. You go pick them up. He doesn't do all the electronic stuff just because, I mean, I know my medical history is in a folder, which is cool. It's not out in the big universe. How do you interface with all that? You probably have to have some computerization, otherwise you wouldn't be able to do the online stuff and all that.
Yeah, we've adopted the technology, but the good technology. I think docs are real quick to embrace all kinds of things like their phone, their smart TV, their smart car. But then when it comes to healthcare, it's a full stop. Because we're not dealing with 2020 technology. We're really dealing with kind of a 2002 technology, if not, you know, farther back, even like Windows 95, where it's very clunky, very complicated, and primarily built to bill your insurance company or to bill Medicare.
Right.
So it's not built as a tool to streamline the practice of medicine, just the billing of it. So now pulling in the, you know, kind of top-tier, best-of technologies for texting, emailing, charting, prescribing, inventory, mobility.
And you can help them with all that, too?
Oh, yeah, we help with all that. You know, now in the world of QR codes, our patients can just scan their prescription bottle to refill their meds, and then they get shipped to them, you know, same day. So people are quickly getting used to the comforts that they know from Amazon Prime, but now for their health care.
Wow. Well, I hope your website crashes. I seriously hope you guys get just mowed over with interest, because I think if you're a primary care physician, because honestly, the system is basically rigged against these guys now and ladies. Mm-hmm. I have a niece. She's brilliant. Neuroscience degree in 3 years, and she looked at getting a medical degree and was like, man, I could never make that work. I just don't see it.
Right.
So she's a physician's assistant, but that's crazy. We lost a really good doctor because of that. But
yeah.
A model like this, she could have come out of medical school, been able to run a practice, and been viable and been doing what she really likes rather than, you know, doing a bunch of, you know, gross insurance work and all that.
You're talking second, third order benefits here where, yes, a lot of good people look at this and say, no, I shadowed a doctor, and that's horrible.
Yeah,
The suicide rate is the highest for physicians. 70% of family docs meet criteria for burnout.
And the family doctors, good ones, man, they're just worth their weight in gold because they know everything. I mean, they just know everything.
Or at least know, you know, how to not get in trouble. Like,
yeah,
okay, I can do a lot of brain stuff, but let's, you know, here's where you need a specialist.
Right. But you guys are the front line, and we need a whole lot more of you, and maybe this would stop the mass retirement.
Yes.
And can you believe it? We're out of time, believe it or not. But
it flies.
We could, like, talk to you forever. We're going to talk to you again, I know, because our phone's going to ring, too. So our guest has been Dr. Josh Umber. It's spelled U-M-B-E-H-R, tricky. But the website is not tricky. It's atlas.md. And I would really encourage people to go there, and I think you will absolutely be wowed. Thanks a lot, Dr. Umber. We really appreciate you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. You can catch us at wethepeopleradio.us. But it's a 23 or 4 to 1 that you can fall in love by the end of this song. So get up, tell the bookie put a bet on not a damn thing will go wrong. The odds are that we will probably be alright. Odds are we gonna be alright. Odds are we gonna be. We the People Radio is now on television in the Reading area. KRDT channel 23.10, Tuesday and Wednesday nights at 10 p.m. on the American Uncensored Network. Welcome to the second half of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Bill, you got anything for us?
No, I was just...
I just change it up there and throw you off guard? And...
No, you're not going to throw me off guard because I was reading about the Falun Gong. So I'm all up to speed.
Oh, well, you can do that. You can announce that part then.
Yeah.
You can find everything about the program at wethepeopleradio.us. So today our focus is China. So the first half was national security. And the second half we have our guest Dr. Chen with us again. And last time that we were speaking with him, there were little bits and pieces of his personal story that came out. And I asked him if he'd be okay to maybe come on and share a little bit of that with us. But I've got his bio on the page for today, and it's relatively comprehensive, so I won't read it all. But he's been active in projects concerning China for over 30 years. He's founded, co-founded, or been a spokesperson for a number of organizations concerning China, and has spoken extensively on issues related to China. He began his activism in 1989 when he helped organize supporting activities during the 1989 Beijing student movement, and he was outraged by the June 4th massacre, and I'm sure that we'll hear more about that. He was elected vice president of the Independent Federation of Chinese Students and Scholars in the U.S., and just the story of people who have come from China and realized what they were up to, and our friend June, who's been on before, her story follows that same pattern. So we were curious to hear from you, sort of what your journey looked like, and how you wound up where you are.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
I'm so honored to be invited back.
Love having you back.
I want to share the things that may or may not known by Americans. I remember that quite a few years ago, so long ago, I don't even remember how many years, but the best friend of mine in America, we talked about a little bit about my life, it just came up, and I told him about when I was entering the college, I was lucky enough to have the opportunity to pick my own desired area for study. I'll talk why I have that privilege of opportunity. And totally unprepared, that was one thing that touch him the most. He was, it brought him to tears. And I was quite surprised. And he said this to me. He said, "Shizhang, you did not know that how much this means to us America. We take things for granted." Mm-hmm. And when you tell me that student in China, at least at my time, did not have the freedom to choose what you study, your area of interest, that is so shocking, so shocking. So I really don't, I'm not sure what will touch Americans more. So I will try to cover this more details that may help them to understand what is communism like, and so they wouldn't think about socialism, and it wouldn't go even near that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so let me start with how I got to where I am. So I was born in 1962, 4 years before the Cultural Revolution. So my childhood, from 1966 to 1970, that was 10 years of Cultural Revolution. So from 4 to 14 or 15, that 10 years of Cultural Revolution. During the Cultural Revolution, the country's education totally stopped. Colleges shut down. Elementary and middle school, they're not shut down, but they're pretty much non-functional. Give you a story. This is a true story. People like in my age all know about it, but the Communist Party has basically castrated that part of the history out of the memory of Chinese people. They cover it up, okay? So during the Cultural Revolution, the teacher dared not to teach, and the student did not have to study. And it was called the Cultural Revolution, so everything is revolution. But basically, everything is rebel. And there's this, there's several role models of students who would, you know, in when the test time came, like in final exam, they would turn in the test sheet without answering any question. And they would be set up as a role model for the country's young kids, because they would be like rebel. The concept rebel, how do I make a connection with American? So one of the things I remember, this may not be completely accurate, but that's what I remember, Hillary Clinton's role model was, I don't remember the professor's name, but that professor, you know, think Lucifer is a, you know, the first revolutionary, because he rebelled against God, okay? It's that kind of
wow. That sounds about right. Yeah, Lucifer's role model. What a great idea.
Yeah. So,
definitely something I want to emulate.
Yeah, that was the kind of things that, you know, that influenced that generation, that 10 years of Cultural Revolution. Everything is upside down. So, finally, the country is about to be bankrupt, you know, towards the end of Cultural Revolution. The Cultural Revolution was brought to an end because Mao Zedong's death. And then the country has to get back on its feet. And the authorities at that time want to revive the education, which has been shut down for 10 years. And so they want to have some role model, kids who studied, kids who were, you know, talented. And so the education authority went around the whole country to search for this kind of a young, talented student. They found 21 of them, and they put them into a special program called, you know, there are different names for it, but some were called, you know, accelerated student program, some were called genius program. 21 of them, and I was one of them. So I, at the age of 15, I was admitted to that program hosted by China University of Science and Technology. It was a big deal at that time. You know, we were on TV, you know, at that time we didn't know we're, you know, young celebrities. So I was just fortunate to be in that kind of situation. And because of that, because that we were kind of special, I was able to choose my own area of study. I chose biology. Other students at that time weren't lucky. They would attend the national exam for entering college, and then a lot of them, their area of study was decided by the state, by the authority.
And so it wasn't your parents, it wasn't you, it wasn't your skill set, it was basically the government decides, like, what you're going to be when you grow up, and you have to go off, learn that, and that basically forms your whole life. Gosh, how could that ever go wrong? And gee, why wouldn't people be deliriously happy about that? Imagine they're not deliriously happy. We have to take a really quick break. Just not to spoiler alert, but Dr. Chen does have a PhD in molecular biology. So we'll hear more about that here in a minute. You're listening to We the People.
Yeah.
without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can. Doctor, my eyes, tell me what is wrong, 'cause I am wise to leave them open for so long. 'Cause I have wandered through this world, and as each moment has unfurled, I've been waiting to awaken from these dreams. People go just where they will. I never noticed them until I got this feeling that it's later than it seems. Doctor, my eyes, tell me what you see. I hear their cries. Just say if it's too late for me.
It's never too late. Especially when you're 15 years old and you get to go to the gifted program at China University. So tell me this. I was thinking on the break, Dr. Chen. Were you not allowed to go to school between the ages of 4 and 14? I mean, was there no school? Did you have homeschool?
There was school, but there are not real school. Let me describe to you.
Was it like American school? You can tell us.
No, not at all. It was.
Were they having climate protests instead of classes?
Right. So there was no college. The university was shut down. That's for sure.
Okay.
But then the elementary school, middle school, they were more and more dysfunctional because the student would rebel against teacher, and the teacher would not. They dare not to be responsible, and so let me give you a glimpse of that. Okay, so towards third grade to fifth grade at that time, where I was like. 12, between 10 and 12 years old, the teacher, okay, gave us something called open book test.
Okay.
Where the examiner, not really exams anymore, they will give you a test, you know, a sheet with questions you can take home.
Oh.
You can look through the book to for an answer.
We used to call that homework, but okay.
right. And then, of course, the student, I mean, without discipline, they don't even want to do that. So for several years, I was whenever it was. The test time came, I became the target of the, my classmates, because they'll copy my answer.
Oh.
And, once I took this test sheet from home and then started to look through the textbook, and my father just happened to, saw what I was doing. And he got very upset. I really see him get that upset. He said, what are you doing? I said, well, that's what teacher told us, I mean, the school told us to do. And he said, as far as you are my son, you're not allowed to do this, okay? Close your book. By the way, both my parents' side of family, they were educated. My father's father, was one of the earliest Chinese students educated abroad. He was educated in Canada. My mother's father was educated in France. And so my mother's father later became president of the, at that time, Poppy University, Shengxia University. And my father's father became a Poppy engineer of the country. So my family, for several generations, they really pay attention to education. So my father, understandably, now I understand. At that time, I didn't.
Yeah, he looks at you doing an open book test, and it's like, yeah!
Right, right. And so that saved me. It wasn't because, you know, I probably would be, you know, the, what do we know? We're just, you know, pre-teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, because of that, I was forced to memorize things, to learn things the right way, and that helped me to get into the special program after Cultural Revolution. But my classmates, they would intercept me and just copy my answer. And so I knew that was wrong because it came from my father. My father told us, so I knew that was wrong. So I would find a way to get my answer to the teacher before they can copy it. That made me the enemy of the class. I was beaten up frequently because whenever they couldn't get my answer, they got upset with me. And that was what my life was. But that also, luckily, that gave me some early foundation to know, you know, what basically right and what's wrong. Honest is right and cheating is wrong. That kind of basic things. And they were not taught. Right? They actually, they were taught the opposite. When students are not disciplined for that, it really, that destroyed a lot of young kids. Another thing that's, so I'm going to give you, instead of the, you know, systematic description, I just give you stories and give you points of, you know, what I have gone through.
Sure.
When I say I became the enemy of the class, there was something that also, besides this, that also made me stood out. So I remember there was a year when I got into the middle school, the first year. And there was this new teacher came in, and then the first thing she came to in the class, she asked us, for all those students who were the offsprings of laborer, you know, people basically, that was a class description. The laborer means peasants, farmers, workers, and all. Those are the people that the Communist Party, the ruling party, are supposed to base the ruling on. So they're the good people. And then those people who are not basically in, if we describe in this country's term, it would be blue collar, right? So the blue collar would be the good people, and the white collar would be the bad people. Well, my parents, they're engineers. They're not laborers.
They're big time white collar. Yeah.
Right, they're big time white collar. And out of the whole class, there were only two people who were the offspring of white collar. So the two of us did not raise our hand. And so that made us stood out. And it turns out that after the Cultural Revolution is ended, the country was trying to get back to normal, and the school did kind of a survey. And out of the whole school, over 1,000 students in elementary school, middle school, there were only two youngsters who did not smoke. That's me and him. And that's how that system during the Cultural Revolution really ruined. I mean, I wouldn't say completely ruined, but that gave them wrong moral guidance. And so that also made me stood out. And so I was really bullied. I personally knew what's bullied like. I was just often become the target of the class. But of course, that also at the agricultural revolution, when the country wanted to revive the education, then I had a little bit of advantage that I studied the agricultural revolution while others. It was led by the system to not study. And so that was my, basically, my elementary and middle school. And then in the college, I have always done quite well in my study. And then in my third year, that university, the university I entered, University of Science and Technology, was a five-year university, while all other universities were four-year. When I entered my third year of study, because I have done quite well in my course study, the university gave me special permission to take examination, for graduate school, and I passed it. And so I graduated 2 years ahead of, what would be the normal schedule. And then that year was 1981, the first year when China's students have the opportunity to study abroad.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah.
Just happened at the exact same time?
That was the time when China opened.
What are the odds of that? Before we start that part, let's take a really quick break and then we'll come back because I think it's fascinating how you wound up where you did. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. I feel alive. That's a huge lie. We can't read your mind. We're kidding. It's just a little joke there. We did not become molecular biologists when we were 18. That did not happen. We've read about people, and now we know one. So you were like 18 years old. You had completed college at that time. And now you were allowed to go. Could you go anywhere, or could you just go to the U.S.?
Well, I happened to come to the U.S. I was given the opportunity to go to France. I did well in the graduate school. So, first of all, about going abroad, okay. The communists come to power in 1949. From 1949 to, like, 1980, no students were allowed to go abroad study except to go to, like, the Soviet Union, you know, the Soviet bloc country, right? And so to anywhere else, the free world, no chance. Right? The 1980 is the, 81 is the first year that there's a very small amount of students that basically the top, you know, maybe it's just extremely small number of students allowed to study abroad. They were paid by the government at that time. So I did so well in my graduate school entrance exam. I was one of the students that was in a country select to send me to study in France. But at the same time, I learned that there are some top university from America is having a program called the China United States Biology Examination Application. These are like the top 100, actually not top 100, top 50 American universities. They got together and they sponsored a program to recruit the brightest students from China to come to pass their test, special design test, and then they will facilitate us to go through the application study in the United States. And so I heard of that one, and I gave up my opportunity to go to France, and that was very bold because that, you know, that opportunity is like a golden opportunity, and I gave it up. There's a story within it that I don't have time to go into, but I gave that up, and then I passed the COSPIA program to come to the United States. So that program, from the whole country, admitted 67 students, and I was one of the 67. So I came to the United States in 1981. So I was 19 years old.
And just to kind of put a little perspective on it at the time, because I know that June has told us when she came here, she thought the communists were great. She thought they were doing a great job. She had been raised with propaganda and had no idea there was any other, you know, any other way, and thought we were all pretending to be free, that we were faking. So I think it took her like 10 years to realize we weren't actually faking. When...
Right.
It sounds like maybe your view of things during the Cultural Revolution and all that was slightly different, maybe?
No, quite the same.
Same, okay. So when you came here, did you think we were scary and bad?
I was so young.
Yeah, that's true. You're 19.
My political, you know, ideas. But I was incredibly... patriotic. And so I believed in what the government said at that time. Now, to be fair, okay, there was 10 years of a golden time, golden 10 years, under even the CCP ruling. That's between 1979 to 1989, exactly. Just 10 years, right? That was the 10-year so-called reform. And to be fair, I mean, to be, you know, objective, that was 10 years of change. That was relatively good, but that got shut down in 1989, and my life had changed, totally changed because of that. I'll get back to that. But when I came to the United States, I speak very little English, and yet just within the first 2 weeks when I was here, my classmate, American classmate, asked me, am I homesick or do I, how do I like it? I said, I feel I was born here. I said, how much I fit in this society, because it just, for some reason, that I just felt the freedom here that I did not have in China. The kind of pressure, the kind of political pressure, the political correctness in Americans have no idea about what political correctness. What I described to you, you know, the whole class raising their hand and being the labor, being the...
Yeah, you're one of two kids who didn't become a chain-smoking blue-collar worker.
Right, and that was, we were politically incorrect.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, so the political correctness, you know, when just people in this country have no idea, that is. The political correctness in under communism is license to kill, basically. Right? But I, for what Jun described, it's true for almost everybody. I changed quite a lot. And that's because when I came to the United States, I learned what I did not learn in China. But my change is slightly different than Jun's. And some people hear what I'm saying, some Chinese people hear what I'm saying, what I describe, may say, okay, you just grew up in the past, China has changed so much. So many people tell me that China has changed so much after the Cultural Revolution. Well, unfortunately, yes, it has changed so much. It has changed, sorry, for worse. China is a lot worse now than even after the Cultural Revolution. And here I want to describe one thing I know, that China has changed for worse, and something fundamental never changed. Okay, that's about the education. After I came to the United States, I studied in the college, I became a graduate student, but I worked as a teaching assistant. That gave me the exposure to the college education. I'm in a graduate study program, but my TA gave me the opportunity to look into the undergraduate.
Oh, that you had just finished. Sure.
I finished it. Yeah, I was doing the graduate study, but I was teaching the undergraduate. Right. And so I was probably more observant than others. And so I thought of one question that was curious to me, because clearly, when I work with undergraduates and those freshman students, China's freshman students were better prepared. That means that China's high school students, they got their math, they got their physics down better. Yet once you get into the graduate student program, China students is no match compared to American college students. And that makes me wonder, say, okay, the transition happened during college. Why there's this transition? And I looked into it, and my discovery shocked me. And I discovered, because in United States education, we have something called a general education. This did not exist in China.
Oh, everything is very specific.
Yeah.
Sure.
So, but the students, okay, the university in the United States or in free world is a place to teach civilization. And the ability to develop civilization. So the product of American education or Western free world education is a human being where you would know the humanity, you will know the history of the civilization, you have the ability to contribute to the furtherment of the civilization. Right? Whereas in China, the product I describe as, robot or artificial intelligence. We did not have a general education. I didn't, at least.
Interesting.
We were immediately, you know, put into science, math.
Sure.
You are specialized in the particular area that the government expects you to go out of college and be a machine.
We have a term for that. We call that being pigeonholed.
Very much so.
Pigeonholed. And we have to take I can't believe a really quick break. Capitalism is wonderful, but it's so, it just interrupts us all the time. The alternatives are bad, but we'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Chen. You're listening to We the People.
Too much money they spend on the moon. Well, I'm sure they make it right. I hope they never sleep at night. They better make some changes and do it soon.
If you're going to study in China, you're not going to see anything yet. You can only see what they tell you to see. Gosh, you know, Dr. Chen, we were talking, Bill and I were chatting here during the break, and I'm sure that that creates a really, really competent workforce, maybe. But
you get exactly what you need and no cross-pollination.
But potentially
so
not a super happy workforce.
Worse than that, and this is we got to really important topic. The reason I said the product of China's education is just robot or artificial intelligence is that you were given skills, but you were not given value.
Yeah.
And we contribute to maybe line of production. We don't contribute to the development of civilization.
Civilization, yeah.
Is that why? Because it kind of makes sense. Our first hour, we were talking about the intellectual property theft and those things. And they can copy anything, but they don't always they don't invent very much. That makes perfect sense. They're not taught to invent.
The Chinese people is one of the hardest working people. It is the system that forced them to where they are now, forced them to be dishonest. There's a deeper reason for that, but before I go on to there, I want to say this to my fellow Americans. Look out. The value that the education gives to young students, this is the most important thing for the youngsters, but also for a country, for a nation, for a future. And look out how the liberals, the progressives, are trying to manipulate our general education system.
Mm-hmm. Take away the history.
Right. Take away the history, demonizing the history.
Yep. Demonizing actually debate and thought and the free exchange of ideas.
Right. And so, let me go back to China. And that explains why I don't think they would need graduate school even now. Right. At least from 1949 to 1990, there's really no graduate study program in China, no real one. I mean, they're in the name of that, but what do I mean by real graduate study? Okay. This is my viewpoint of the free world education, where when you go through a four-year program, education, you came out a college student, you still don't know what you're going to do for your career. And that's why it's very common. A larger percentage of college graduates, they would go out to work for 1 or 2 years. And then they will develop what they will be really interested in, and they'll go to graduate school. That's where they do their specialized study. After the specialized study, they focus on one area. They're a doctor, they're a lawyer, they're a biologist, they're a musician, and artist, and that. The college do not yet fix what's their career yet. The college prepared them, gave them the value to then go on their next stage of career. And that's not the case in China. It's not the case in Soviet Union, right? Once you come out of college, you're molded. You'll become that robot. You'll become that artificial intelligence.
Yeah, your path has been chosen.
Yeah, yeah. You then become a cog of the society, cog of machine. You don't have your own value. And so that already hurts their capability of invention. But the current situation where a whole nation is so prone to deception, stealing is deception, is because the system under the CCP forces people to be dishonest in many ways. In many, many different ways. The worst way, of course, is the political way. I have described in my previous interview that, you know, there's always political purge. There are always political movements. And to protect themselves, you never know when you'll be sold out or backstabbed by your friends. You become devious. You become protective. And if necessary, you sell others out. You know, you sell your friends out, backstab them. Mm-hmm. And so that forces, unfortunately, it's true. I mean, I'm using the word. People may not realize that it forces people to be dishonest, to cut corners. See, the traditional Chinese culture, there's an important concept called, Chinese word called the shen du, meaning be vigilant when alone. Because when you're alone is when nobody watches you. And that's the time that you're prone to do wrong things. So the traditional Chinese culture teaches one to be honest to oneself, self-honesty. And unfortunately, the self-honesty is losing in this country as well. I'm sorry to warn that. But in China, the self-honesty was forced away by the government. And because of that, when you don't have that, when you don't have that self-restraint, self-honesty, when you study in the United States, when you come across a business secret or important discovery that could make you a lot of money, you'll steal it. And once you've stolen it, of course you cannot use it in the United States. Where's the best place for you to steal that and make money for yourself? China. And that's why it's not the Chinese people, it's the system that have forced them to act this way. And that is why there's never been that large number of people who are so prone to take advantage or to steal, to cut corner, to benefit from dishonesty, to not count on hard work, but trickery.
Yeah, you see that. You see that in every field, too. Every product, every discipline, you see the corners being cut and the
And last time I talked about the 1,000 talent program.
Right.
Yeah. Last week in the United States, the supposed head of this program or a liaison person in the United States was arrested in New York. And you can check, look into that news. Okay. So we're talking about 1,000 talent. These are the top, those the brightest scholars that the government would recruit. If they don't, they're not bright, then the government wouldn't, or the Chinese communist regime wouldn't even let them. So these are the brightest scientists, engineers, right, the regime would pay attention to. So they're supposed to be role models. But they are
right.
Also at the same time.
But they can't.
The leading sea. And that's the scary part. That reminds us. I don't know whether you think about it. I thought about the Nazi doctors.
Yes.
They are experts in medicine or in whatever, but they are the worst of the worst.
Using it for evil. Dr. Chen, we have run out of time, believe it or not. That was a swift hour. We will have to do this again. We appreciate you sharing.
Yeah, we've got to have you back. That was such great information.
Thank you for sharing your story with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You can find all this information in the archive of today's program at wethepeopleradio.us, and you've been listening to KCNR 96.5 FM, 1460 AM.